This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Robert Morley, contributing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet Magazine and today's host for the Trumpet Hour. Joel Hilliker is out of town and he graciously asked me to fill in for him. So hold on to your hats. We have a wild ride for you today. World events are moving at breakneck speed. Not since the days of the lead up to World War II have conditions been so dangerous or changing so quickly. You won't want to miss today's show. That's also why I'd like to encourage you at the top to subscribe to our Trumpet Weekly newsletter. Our writers work tirelessly to bring you the week's most important news and intelligence, and it's absolutely free, no cost, no obligation, and we'll never give your email address away. So if you want to understand the details behind world events, if you want analysis on how they fit into prevailing trends and what that means for the economy, social conditions, international relations, or geopolitics, and most importantly, how that fits into Bible prophecy, you need to read the Trumpet Weekly. So join the more than 32,000 other subscribers by going to thetrumpet.com and clicking on the subscriptions tab. Thank you for listening in. As I said, we have a great program for you today. Lots of important news to discuss, and later on, a special treat for you towards the end of the program. So stick with us, especially if you're a fan of archaeology. I have here with me in the studio some of our writing staff, our Asia analyst, Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
Brent Noctegal, who follows the Middle East region.
Hello.
Anthony Chibarway, who will bring us up to speed on what's going on in the United States and the English-speaking world. Good to have you here, Anthony.
Thank you. Good to be
here. And Richard Palmer via Skype from our news bureau in the UK. Hi, Richard.
Good afternoon.
Our top story this week comes from Europe, and it's a very important story. The power structure within the continent is shifting radically. Nationalism is rearing its ugly head. And from some perspectives, Europe appears to be tearing itself apart. Yet, within that all, there is a new force, a unifying force that is, well, it's really just a reincarnation of an old force within Europe, but it's shaping geopolitics in a way that we haven't seen, this world hasn't seen since World War II. But before we get into all that, Richard, let's go ahead and have you give us a rundown of some of the more important news out of Europe this week.
Well, there was a bit of a conference in Paris that you may have heard of with a few important people that has been all that's really what's dominated a lot of the headlines, that Paris climate change conference. A bit more interestingly, there's been a lot of discussion about the Schengen zone within Europe, and that I think has major possible implications for the European Union. The Schengen zone is one of the most visible fruits of the European Union's success. It means you can travel around just about all of mainland Europe as if it's one country. An outsider going to Europe doesn't have to get a German visa, then a French visa, then a Belgian visa, then a Dutch visa. However, this, as I said, very visible success is under a lot of serious strain. We've spoken over the last few weeks about this Dutch call for a mini Schengen, kind of similar to the 18th century Holy Roman Empire. That idea has been gaining more traction this week. There are growing calls to kick Greece out of the Schengen zone. The Greeks have been accused of not allowing EU officials to patrol their border and to help in Greece. There's also some disputes over the bailout. It's kind of slowing down. Greece is trying to use the border situation to gain a reprieve. Other powers are getting more and more frustrated with Greece and so want to kick them out of Schengen to punish them. And then there's also some very serious talks about just shutting Schengen down for the next 2 years, just suspending it, doing away with it. So that could be very big for Europe, just having this very visible fruit of European Union being dissolved. And then finally, the other big kind of trend we're seeing in Europe this week is a lot of European powers now getting more involved in Syria. So on Wednesday night, Britain approved its bombing of ISIS in Syria. The German parliament are holding a similar vote today, and that's to approve a military mission of up to 1,200. So those events aren't going to make a huge difference to Syria. We're talking about pretty insignificant numbers here. It's not enough to change the conflict, but it will drag Europe much deeper into that conflict and much deeper into the Middle East.
Oh, well, thanks, Richard, for that. Just let me get this straight about Greece. Greece is being told that they need to do more to stop the immigration, or Europe's going to shut down their borders with Greece. But it seems to me like it's Germany's fault for fueling this migration to begin with.
Yeah, that's certainly a good chunk of that. But I think the thing is that Greece is just letting a whole load of refugees go through their country into the Balkans. Hungary has closed its borders to the Balkans. A lot of other nations are following suit. So now, with immigrants being allowed to flow through Greece into the Balkans, they're just kind of piling up in the Balkans. They can't move on to the rest of Europe from there. And it's becoming this bigger and bigger problem within the Balkans. And so they're blaming Greece now for not doing more to register these immigrants as they come into Greece, not doing more to kind of distribute them throughout Europe rather than just letting them travel on through, and not doing more to secure its own borders. It's more about politics than it is about immigration, because Greece doesn't share a land border with any other Schengen nation. So kicking them out of Schengen isn't going to make any difference to the immigration situation.
Poor Greeks, they just can't seem to catch a break. Okay, thanks for that, Richard.
No.
Big story this week from your region.
Well, the top story I wanted to focus on is an article that we have in the Trumpet Weekly this week called Microstate and Superpower, the Vatican in International Politics. And this is a paper from the Konrad Adenauer Foundation. The original is about 8,500 words long. We've trimmed that down to about a tenth of that for the Trumpet Weekly. So it's a very, very abridged version. Before I get into what it says, just a little bit about who wrote it. This Konrad Adenauer Foundation is the think tank for Angela Merkel's CDU party. And in Germany, all the different political parties tend to have a think tank that's affiliated with them to kind of do the heavy lifting of the intellectual work in terms of thinking through foreign policy, domestic policy, all these different things. That's where a lot of those serious discussions go on. So this gives us some great insight into the thinking with Angela Merkel's party. And it's absolutely fascinating, this article. Right at the start, it notes that the Vatican, quote, has in fact been involved in central decision-making and events of world politics for a long time, acting patiently behind the scenes, particularly since the middle of the 20th century. And it talks about how the Pope and the Vatican has been playing a more and more important role as the 20th century goes on. He talks some about how the Pope's special status as the leader of both the Church and the state of the Vatican gives him a very unique and powerful diplomatic position. And it talks about how the Vatican has positioned itself as neither being affiliated with kind of the capitalist West or the communist nations during the Cold War. And so because of that, they've kind of seen as an honest broker. A lot of ex-communist nations feel like they can reach out to and rely on the Vatican. And then it goes on to give a whole load of examples of the Vatican's power. And there wasn't space to include much of this in the Trumpet Weekly, but it's just some great concrete proof of some of the things we've been saying at the Trumpet for a long time. So it talks about Pope John Paul II's role in the fall of the USSR. It goes through a whole load of different disputes that the Catholic Church has been involved in mediating, going all the way back to a conflict in 1978 between Chile and Argentina about the Beagle Channel. And that was getting heated. The Pope stepped in, offered to act as a mediator, and brought both sides to an agreement. And then it has a whole bunch of really interesting detail about more recent agreements. Cuba, we've talked a lot about on this program, and about how that's all been driven by the Pope. It's also mediating between the Colombian government and the Marxist guerrillas. And then even in the Iran deal, in the Middle East, it's always doing a lot with Israel and the Palestinians. But then with the Iran deal, it talks about how U.S. bishops met with four high-ranking ayatollahs in Iran in March 2014, and how they were talking about nuclear weapons and diplomatic rapprochement. And it says here that this article wrote about how this para-governmental diplomatic action with informal contacts by non-diplomats can prepare the ground for more official cooperation, not least in the nuclear area. So the Catholic Church was very involved even in paving the ground for the Iran deal. In the Ukraine crisis, they were involved. Even now in Syria, the Vatican and the Pope is involved. And it writes, despite the complexity of such conflicts, this paper calls it the Holy See, or the Vatican is not giving up its efforts to provide mediation in the region. Recently, Iran's vice president for women and family affairs, for instance, stated that Pope Francis has the ability to bring nations closer together, and through this, perhaps he can influence governments. So it's got a strong track record of mediation. It also talks about the strong role of Catholic charities, how they generate a great deal of international goodwill towards the Catholic Church and strengthening their role as a mediator.
Now, Richard, I think a lot of people would be surprised, you know, just to hear how active the Vatican is on the world stage. But this isn't something that should really shock people if they have an understanding of history, is it?
No, it's not. They have been very active before. It does talk about some of that history with the investiture controversy, this paper also talks about just how the Catholic Church has been forced to go through a kind of a diplomatic transformation over the past few hundred years, just because of now the fact that it no longer rules a major state the way that it did when it ruled the papal states and a good chunk of Italy back during the Middle Ages. So there's been some change in the way that the Catholic Church has related with the rest of the world, but it's still exercising the same or a similar level of power that it used to even in the past.
Well, I could see some people saying, you know, the Vatican, it's, you know, the Vatican City is a small state. They don't have a lot of money. But the Vatican really does wield a lot of influence on the world scene. And why is that?
Right. Well, that's exactly what the article notes in its conclusion. It writes, at first glance, the Vatican is a microstate without massive resources. But be that as it may, it does have a great deal of symbolic power, not least thanks to it partially sharing its identity with a world religion, which makes it a superpower after all, religiously, culturally, and socially. And a good chunk of the reason why it has that power is this strong track record as a mediator, the fact that a lot of nations really trust the Vatican as an honest broker. I mean, look at Cuba. There are not many nations around the world that can unilaterally completely reverse the United States' government's position on a serious part of its foreign policy. The Catholic Church has the influence, has the ability to do that. And so if you want to influence your neighbors that way, you go to the Vatican. And so that mediation is a great or a big part of its power. The other thing that this article draws attention to is the Pope's growing role now as a moral authority. And basically they make the case that the Pope is really is moving beyond just claiming as the head of Catholics, but he's really kind of developing his position now as the world's foremost moral authority, almost as the speaker of the world's conscience. And so this article talks about how the Pope is reaching out beyond the faith by putting forward ethical universal arguments rather than Catholic moral ones. And it says, consequently, the Vatican is developing into an informal authority on moral standards, reaching far beyond the boundaries of Catholicism. And then it talks about how in its encyclicals, they're kind of changing from being messages to the Catholic Church to messages to the world. And so it writes that in these letters, the Pope is addressing the global public, not just as head of the church and head of state, but as a moral authority. So it's got this power as a mediator, which is very big in its own right. But then add to that just this great moral authority, and you have a power with some serious heft.
Yeah, that seems like it's exactly what we're seeing coming under the Vatican, especially after the global financial crisis. It's been very vocal. Is that also what we're seeing a little bit with these climate talks and the Pope's position on climate change and global warming?
Yes, exactly. Yes, he's spoken out a lot about this, especially in the weeks leading up to this climate summit. And he was in Africa before that, and he was talking about the climate summit, and that fits perfectly in with his role there. It's something that a lot of people feel very strongly about, and so by putting forward this case or by arguing that we need to do things about global warming, he is cementing that position as a global moral authority that stretches beyond Catholicism. And at the same time, it puts forward this kind of Catholic third way between communism and capitalism of a compassionate but strong government influenced by the Catholic Church taking care of these moral conundrums such as the environment. So that's a perfect example of that.
And a compelling message, I would think, for a lot of people around this world.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. This gets really interesting, though, not just on the global warming, but now as you look at Europe trying to solve all of its problems and all of its divisions, because, you know, we talked about Schengen and how there's a whole core components of the European Union are on the brink of falling apart right now. And now you have this think tank that's affiliated with Germany's ruling party, talking about the power of the Vatican, and specifically the powers of the Vatican as a mediator, as bringing different sides together, as a peacemaker, as healing conflicts. And you could really see the Catholic, you could really see Europe or Germany turning to the Catholic Church with this track record and inviting the Catholic Church to come in and act as a negotiator in Europe, as a mediator between the different nations in Europe, and to play a greater role in the European Union.
As a unifier.
Sorry?
As a unifier.
As a unifier, exactly. And that's exactly what Mr. Armstrong pointed to the role of the Catholic Church all along. Here's what he wrote in the 70s. He said that in only one way can this resurrected Holy Roman Empire, meaning this unified power in Europe, be brought to fruition: by the good offices of the Vatican, uniting church and state once again with the Vatican astride and ruling. And really, it's not a big leap from where we are now and from things this paper's talking about to get to exactly what Mr. Armstrong was talking about there.
Yeah, absolutely fascinating, Richard. Religion is back. It's back on the world scene. We are seeing that despite all the accounts of its demise, we are seeing a revival, and the Vatican's power is really showing that. Well, thank you very much, Richard, for your time today. Appreciate that. Let's now go ahead and move over to Asia. There was a lot of important news this week in Asia. Jeremiah, I know a lot of news from the Pacific and even across the continent. And with all the developments happening in Russia and China, you know that has to be worrying Europe and America. So, Jeremiah, please go ahead and give us the rundown of some of the more important stories from your region.
Okay, sure. Well, first, Russia has promised a response to Montenegro's move to join NATO. Russia, of course, views NATO as its rival in many ways and is adamantly opposed to any expansion of NATO, especially if that expansion pushes eastward toward Russia. So Moscow says it will not sit idly by as Montenegro there in the Balkans begins to join the organization. So this really just shows that old east-west divide, which many people would like to think vanished when the Soviet Union collapsed, is still around, and it's really becoming deeper and more pronounced. And then also China this week vowed to enhance cooperation with Russia in the fight against terrorism. Chinese President Xi Jinping said on Monday that China is prepared to back Russia in its fight against terrorism, including against the Islamic State there in Syria and other Islamic elements in Syria. So I think it's unlikely that China will take on any actual military role in the larger scheme of that Syrian war, but in terms of diplomacy and even fighting cyber terrorism and some other indirect facets of the war, China will robustly support Russia.
Thanks, Jeremiah. So from your region, what would you say is the big story this week?
I'd say the big story is that the nations of East Asia, the smaller ones there, are being forced to choose between alliance to the United States and allegiance to China. These smaller Asian countries would rather not choose between the two. For decades, they've managed to sort of delicately balance themselves in the middle there and maintain good relations with both the U.S. and China. But now, China is challenging the existing order. And that is forcing these smaller nations to pick a side. We've published an article this week called "Trying Not to Choose, a Region Pulled Between China and America." And this article does an excellent job showing the squeeze that is on these nations like Malaysia, Cambodia, Thailand, Myanmar, Singapore, the Philippines, Laos, Vietnam, Korea, Japan, and others. And the article says, I'll just read a quote from it here. It says, "East Asia is the scene for an unprecedented experiment in international relations. Never before have so many countries been so intertwined economically with one big power, China, while looking to another, America, as the ultimate guarantor of their security. So far, the experiment has seemed a stunning success. For 40 years, America has not just kept the peace, it has enabled a continental economic boom. And the biggest beneficiary of that has been China. Yet, that order is now fraying as China chafes under what it sees as an American-led world order that is impeding its rise and its natural regional predominance. In 2016, the tensions that this fraying produces may become acute, posing awkward questions for other countries in Asia." So the author of this piece is Simon Long, and he stresses 2016 over and over again in this article as a time that we could really see some major shifts in the whole power balance and the dynamic there in Asia. And I've spoken on the program before about why I agree with that point, since China and also Russia really view President Obama as a real pushover in terms of foreign policy. And they think that that situation could change in 2017 if someone like Trump or Cruz becomes the president of America. So they really see these last 13 months or so of President Obama's term as precious time in which they can push and almost have kind of a carte blanche and just pushing to dismantle the American-led world order. I'll just read one more quote from Long's article here. He says, "The two big powers, meaning China and the U.S., are now rivals in a growing number of spheres. Asia is where the rivalry is most intense, and it will become more so in 2016. And so that'll happen largely because China will continue building and militarizing artificial islands in the South China Sea, and it's likely that Beijing could even declare an air defense identification zone there, just as it did in the East China Sea. I think that was back in 2013. So the result of all this is that many of these smaller Asian nations are just being forced to choose sides on matters about which they would prefer to maintain a degree of neutrality. In recent months, for example, we've seen Singapore agree to act as host to a new fleet of American warships. We've seen the Philippines relax its opposition to the presence of U.S. forces on a key matter there. And now a lot of these nations are also being forced to choose sides in economic matters. Listeners may remember that even some really staunch U.S. allies ignored America's objections and became founding shareholders in China's new Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, the AIIB, which comes online in early 2016. 2016 is also when the U.S.'s TPP, or the Trans-Pacific Partnership, will be finalized. This partnership excludes China, and it has been explicitly advertised as an American attempt to kind of prevent China from writing all the rules for trade among those Pacific economies. And as a response to this TPP, in 2016, China will also most likely finalize a trade bloc called the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership. That's with about 15 other Asian states. So all these economic groups, in theory, they are agreements that could be complements to each other. They wouldn't have to be this kind of us versus them competition. But that's not how it's panning out. The end of this article, it concludes saying, "The trend in economics, as in diplomacy, is towards parallel sets of institutions. The old ones, where America has a leading role, and the new, where America is absent and China dominates. It is a rather alarming trend, and one likely only to intensify in 2016.
Yeah. Thanks for that, Jeremiah. I wonder if you would just comment a little more on the Trans-Pacific Partnership. If it doesn't go through, I think a lot of Americans take a look at big trade deals like this and they just think, okay, it's big business throwing American workers under the bus, you know, selling them out to cheap foreign labor. But maybe you could just comment on what are the implications if this doesn't go through. If for some reason the Trans-Pacific Partnership doesn't go through, what does that mean for America's allies in the region?
Well, I would just say if it fails to materialize, if the U.S. fails to finalize this agreement, it would just be, you know, one more in a long list of black eyes that America suffers and just worrying indications, red flags that Washington gives to its allies around the world, showing that that America no longer can be counted on as a reliable ally.
Yeah, it's funny you bring that up because when you take a look at U.S. foreign policy recently, and you've pointed out this in the past, it has taken some big blows, thinking Ukraine, thinking Georgia, and the world is looking at that. And we know our Asian allies in the Pacific are looking at that. Maybe just before I let you go, just take a couple of moments, if you wouldn't mind, and talk about, you know, some implications for nations like Taiwan and even Japan as they look and see America really being untrustworthy for its allies in Europe and elsewhere.
Sure. Yeah. Well, Taiwan, for example, they have a big presidential campaign that's scheduled for January 16th, 2016. And for the last 8 years, they've had President Ma in power, who has been very submissive to China. He's really positioned Taiwan as subservient to China. He's basically given in to Beijing on a whole range of key political areas there. But analysts predict that a new power will come in to replace Mao as kind of a backlash against his subservience to China. So it seems like what we have happening, you can see it in Taiwan, you can see it in a lot of other nations, you have these two camps emerging among the weaker or the smaller Asian states. Some of those are preparing to ally themselves with China. They see that the U.S. is a sinking ship. They want to abandon it and just, you know, prepare their nation to be sort of allied with the rising power there of China. And then other camps are still holding out hope, and they are building up their own militaries. They're trying to shore up alliances with America and even with each other. We see some of that happening between Japan and South Korea. They're still hoping that they can somehow resist the rising
power. So long term for our friends in Taiwan, you know, what's the future hold for them?
Well, the party that's expected to come into power in Taiwan, they're running on a platform of independence. Taiwan will never be allied with China. We want to reverse all of these moves that President Ma made toward giving in to China. However, I would imagine that they will come into power, but I don't think they'll be able to maintain that stance. I think that the reality, just the facts on the ground, we'll see the power that political party end up taking a stance that's pretty similar to what Ma has taken, or else it will incur the wrath of China. It could even lead to a conflict.
Okay, thank you, Jeremiah. These articles that we've been talking about are in this week's Trumpet Weekly, a very informative, high-quality report that we produce each week. It contains the most significant news stories and the best commentary from the very best sources. I'd like to encourage you to subscribe to this free weekly news report. Just go online to thetrumpet.com and click on the subscribe tab at the top and become a subscriber. Coming up, the news from Anglo-America and a special report from the Middle East, and later our lightning round of important headlines from all our panelists. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
This is Trumpet Hour with your host, Robert Morley, filling in for Joel Hilliker today. You're listening to our Week in Review program, looking at the big stories from around the world from this past week. We've been talking about the Vatican's power within Europe and around this world and how it has greatly expanded under Pope Francis, and how also U.S. power in Asia is being chipped away by China, and how the smaller Asian nations are trying to walk a fine line between allying with America and not offending their huge neighbor. But it's time now to turn to Anglo-America. Anthony, what's been happening in the English-speaking world?
With the memory of Afghanistan fresh in his mind, Putin will understand his inner quagmire. That's a quote from the United States President Barack Obama. He predicted that Russian President Vladimir Putin will soon realize that his strategy in Syria is not working, and he will start supporting the United States and the way they are leading in the Middle East. But in one of the articles that we have in the Trumpet Weekly, Charles Krauthammer commented, he said, "The Russians left Afghanistan 25 years ago. The people who are stuck in a quagmire today are Americans under President Obama." Now, the other big story that we have, and I think it's probably the biggest story we have insofar as the global economy is concerned, and that's that on Monday, the International Monetary Fund elevated the Chinese yuan into its international reserve currency basket. It now joins the dollar, the euro, the yen, and the pound. Now, the proportion of the yuan in the global monetary transactions is only 2%, 2.8% compared to the United States' 45%. But this development shows that the era of the United States dollar dominating the world currency is coming to an end.
Thanks for that, Anthony. The big story from Anglo-America today.
The big story this week, and I'm sure it's going to be a big story for the weeks to come, is the San Bernardino shooting that occurred on Wednesday. 14 people were killed, 21 people were wounded, and most of them were employees from the county where the suspects worked. Now, the suspects were U.S.-born Saeed Farooq and his Pakistani wife. Now, the big question about this whole incident has been, was this workplace violence or was this a terrorist attack? Now, of course, the suspects worked with the group that they attacked, so there is an element of workplace violence right there. But was it a terrorist act as well? Now, that's really the most important question, and here's some facts about this situation. This couple were heavily armed when they walked into this building. They were wearing tactical attire, and they had an arsenal of ammunition and pipe bombs at their home. In fact, they had thousands of rounds of ammunition and a dozen homemade pipe bombs in their home. Is that evidence of a terrorist plot? Well, some law enforcement officials who have been investigating this story say that they've been trying to figure out whether the bombs that they had assembled in their home, whether they matched some that were outlined in Al-Qaeda's Inspire magazine. This magazine had descriptions of how to make pipe bombs, and law enforcement have been trying to make that connection, and they've been finding some connection, but then at the same time, they say that this magazine is found anywhere online. So who knows whether they really is a connection. But that's just one piece of evidence. But there's more. The FBI also uncovered evidence that Farouk communicated with extremists both domestically and abroad for the past few years. And some of those people that he communicated with have been under investigation from the FBI. The FBI has been keeping tabs on these people some of these people he has communicated with. One of them included a terrorist from Al-Shabaab. That's the terrorist organization that's based in Somalia. And then he has communicated with terrorists from the Al-Nusra Front. Now, that's a terrorist organization that's associated with Al-Qaeda. Now, in all these cases, in all these instances, the FBI did make a connection. They knew that he was communicating with this terrorist, but they didn't think, it didn't really raise a red flag for the FBI, so they didn't continue investigating him. So the question still comes again, was this a terrorist act? Now, just before we came on air, there was even more evidence to indicate the terrorist connection. The wife of Sayyid Farouk did actually communicate with ISIS, and she posted comments on Facebook pledging allegiance to the Islamic State. What more do we need to prove the terrorist connection in this case? This shouldn't have been a question. This shouldn't have been a question. It shouldn't have taken us this long to make that connection. The shooting occurred on Wednesday morning, and even then there was this talk about communicating with terrorist organizations. And it's only now that it seems as if now law enforcement officials are going to make that conclusion that this definitely was a terrorist this was a terrorist attack. But I think what the big problem in this case is that why does it take us so long to conclude that this was a terrorist act? Why do we have to go around and try to decide whether it was just a workplace violence attack? Because these are serious issues that affect the national security of the country, it shouldn't take us this long to come to this conclusion.
Yeah, it does seem like there's something wrong when you have to tippy-toe around telling the truth. I mean, what is the truth of this matter? We have, as you mentioned, two individuals, Muslims, traveled to Saudi Arabia, came back. The gentleman in question, when he came back, suddenly he starts dressing less Western, growing the Islamic beard. That's typical of many Muslims around the world. The attack dressed in tactical gear with remote control bombs that thankfully didn't go off, that did not explode, filled with shrapnel and nails and twisted metal, bulletproof vest. This wasn't something that, you know, somebody's at a party and then suddenly, you know, they lose their temper and they pull out a gun that, you know, that they've been carrying with a concealed weapon permit or something. This was something that threatens American people. Are dying here. This is terrorism on America's shore, and there's answers that Americans deserve to have.
Certainly, Mr. Morley, 66 people have been arrested in the past 18 months for plotting terrorist attacks, in the United States. And as you said, some of them were refugees. You see, this is not a question of is the United States a kind nation? Are we compassionate? Do we want to help refugees? Of course we want to help refugees. We should help refugees in ways that do not endanger the nation. That's the most important factor. We have to protect the nation first. So it's not about compassion. It's about protecting the nation. It's about protecting 300 million citizens here in the nation.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you very much for bringing us that report, Anthony. I know it's disturbing to talk about some of these things, but it is an important issue that needs to be raised. Moving on, we will now look to the Middle East, and we will turn to Mr. Noctegal to give us a rundown of the news items that have taken place in that region.
Well, just a couple of headlines at the top here. We have the leader of the Islamic State inside the Sinai Peninsula, Shadeh Elmani. He was in the Gaza Strip this week, according to Israel Channel 2 News, in discussions with Hamas there and with the military wing of Hamas, and they were discussing weapons transfers between Hamas and the Gaza Strip and the Islamic State inside the Sinai Peninsula. While Hamas formally opposes the Islamic State, they look to be cooperating together in their joint efforts, not just against Israel, but particularly against Egypt. We've talked about that before, how Egypt looks to be just in a very threatened position by the Islamic State rising in Libya and in the Sinai Peninsula on its borders. And here we have them colluding with Hamas, an enemy of Sisi's government in Egypt. So that's something to watch over there. And then also the big news that went back and forth this week continues to surface, just how the relations between Russia and Turkey continuing to sour over the downing of the Russian jet over Turkish skies that occurred a week and a half ago. Russia has sanctioned Turkey, freezing the tourist exchange between the two countries. Russia also banned certain Turkish agricultural imports as well. And then Moscow came out and suggested that Erdogan, the leader of Turkey, was actually purchasing oil from the Islamic State. So he's just fired that other bit of propaganda, what some are calling propaganda. In fact, the second in command inside Turkey, Prime Minister Davutoğlu, he said that these lies from Russian President Putin are similar to that was produced by the Cold War Soviet propaganda machine. And then Erdogan fired back that actually no, Russia is involved with buying oil from the Islamic State. And then he put he offered a little bit of a contest with Putin. He said, let's present the facts of who's actually involved in this, and whoever loses or whoever is proved to be purchasing Islamic State oil, let that leader step down. So we'll see if Putin does end up producing his facts here in that regard.
Thank you very much, Brent. Now, you have a little bit of a special story for us now, something perhaps a little bit out of the ordinary, although you have talked about similar issues before. There was kind of a big find over in the Middle East this week, wasn't there?
Right. Unless you were living underneath a rock this week, then you wouldn't know what I'm about to talk about, and that is the discovery of a seal impression of a king of Judah, specifically King Hezekiah, son of Ahaz, king of Judah. That's what this little seal impression, what they call over there in Israel, a bulla, says, which was found just outside the Temple Mount, or just south of the Temple Mount. Now, this is a piece of clay that is stamped on a document, which seals a document, and it shows you the author of that document, or at least by whose authority that document was sent. And over time, what happens is the document is wasted away, yet this little seal made of clay, just as pottery is when it's petrified, lasts for eons and eons of time, these little seals get to last for eons and eons of time. In fact, in this case, 2,700 years. Now, this has been reported heavily on the Trumpet Daily program and the Trumpet Daily radio show as well. Stephen Flurry was actually over in Israel to discuss this with the archaeologist, Dr. Elot Mazar, that discovered the artifact a couple of weeks ago. And he's just reported heavily on it and just talked about how this is just another piece of evidence that is proving that the Bible is an accurate record of historical events relating to this area, and even bringing out how King Hezekiah himself seems to be one of the most provenanced rulers in Israel for the whole biblical period, just because of artifacts that have come out in Assyria and now in Jerusalem. Now, it's a really cool find. Dr. Mazar has said it was probably the most important find that she has personally made over her years. And this is important to know because she's the one that has discovered King David's palace. She's the one that discovered Nehemiah's wall. She's the one that has discovered a building built by King Solomon. Now, all of those are open to some conjecture because we haven't found those names written on those walls. Yet here she found a beautiful testament to a biblical personage that is beyond disrepute. It's so obvious. You've got the first name, you've got the last name, and you've got his title, King of Judah. And what's important about this one specifically, this bulla, is that it was found in the right archaeological context as well. This is incredibly important. Over 20 years ago, there was another bulla of Hezekiah that actually surfaced, but it looks very, very similar to this one, but it received no acclaim because it came up on the black market. It was not able to be proved where it came from. It could have been a forgery. So people said, well, it's interesting, but we can't prove that it is not a fake. Yet this one was found in an area coming from the correct layer in a controlled scientific excavation. Nobody planted this sucker. He was right there in the dirt from the 8th century BC that we can date clearly in a nice layer. And then it comes out that we've found Hezekiah's name.
Absolutely stunning, Brent. Correct me if I'm wrong here, but this bulla where it was found, this is a dig that Herbert W. Armstrong College worked with, and it was, in particular, it was found in an area very close to where you yourself were actually excavating at one point.
Right. It's the history of this patch is goes back about 100 or so years, and we have had the chance to be digging over there really close to where this was found with Dr. Elot Mazar. We were there on that same dig where this was discovered, and if I could just go back in a little bit of time just to show you how remarkable it is that it was found now. This particular area was first excavated back in the 19th century by Sir Charles Warren before there was a state of Israel. He did a few digs in this area and he did a probe into the ground right here through the different layers of history going back all the way to this period. But he didn't excavate all of the ground. He left a patch. But he said that he found these discoveries of this big wall that was there. So come 1967, just as Israel wins the Six-Day War, we have another lady, Dame Kathleen Kenyon, a British archaeologist. She goes and digs right by Charles Warren's dig. And she digs a 2-meter by 2-meter probe as well into this same area to further give a date to what the walls Charles Warren found. But she doesn't dig all the way to bedrock. She leaves a patch of soil, as all good archaeologists do, just in case there is technology that develops in the future that can give a more conclusive date to whatever artifact they're trying to work out the date of. Archaeology is something that develops over time. So she left a little patch of dirt there. Now, this same spot was then excavated in 1968 to 1978 under the digs by Professor Benjamin Mazar and Herbert W. Armstrong and Ambassador College. They worked there for 10 years in the huge area in the southern wall of the Temple Mount. And as their dig proceeded through that decade, the last patch of dirt that they got to was this one. And they didn't touch it because they were done with their 10 years, but they got right to that place. Now, Dr. Elot Mazar comes back to a similar area just on the other side of the wall from where this was found in 1986 and 1987, and she digs there. She doesn't dig in this hole just on the other side of the world. She leaves it, other side of the wall, sorry. She leaves it there. And it's not until 2009, 2010, when we get to be involved in this dig as well, that Dr. Elot Mazar says, let's dig away that extra meter that was left behind by Charles Warren, by Kathleen Kenyon, that my grandfather didn't touch. And what does she find in it? She finds an inscription from a king of Judah that could have been discovered 100 years ago. The earth could have been removed 100 years ago. But it wasn't till now that it eventually surfaces. Now, one thing I would add, if that earth was taken, the archaeologists back then, Charles Warren or Kathleen Kenyon, they would not have found this. Bulla because it is tiny. It is so small. It looks like every other patch of dirt that you're removing. Only in the past decade has a technology developed in archaeology that ensures that everything of value is discovered, and that is called wet sifting. It's simple. You sift the dirt, and then you spray that the remaining clumps of rock or whatever with water, and that the whatever's on them, whatever inscriptions on those stones, pops out. And that's where this was discovered, in wet sifting. Now, just to think of that timeline just shows how wonderfully amazing it is that it was left for now to be discovered.
Just waiting for us now.
Just waiting for
the world
for us.
Now. Yep. Fantastic, Brent. Thank you very much. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Go there to receive your free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. All these stories are there and more. We'll finish the program with our lightning round of important news from all our panelists coming up next.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
You're listening to the Trumpet Hour, the week in review. It's time now for our lightning round. One last look at some of the headlines from this week that caught our attention. Richard, go ahead and take it away.
The tax Europe cannot afford to pay is the title of an article we have in the Trumpet Weekly that I'd like to talk about for a couple of minutes. It's from the New York Times, but it makes an absolutely fascinating point. It goes through how a lot of militaries, all the militaries really in Europe, have been cutting funding in recent years. They're still struggling with the economy. They've not really come out from this economic crisis. But now they need to spend a lot more on their military. They want to spend a lot more on their military, but they're still in massive debt. So what do they do? And this author suggests reviving this pan-European financial transaction tax in order to fund pan-European military spending, which really ties together two what would be milestone events in terms of military European Union. A pan-European tax would be a really transformative event, taking Europe a long way towards becoming a superpower and a united state. This is a key thing that has brought different federations together as one power in the past. And then at the same time, using that to increase Europe's military power and maybe in some kind of pan-European military way. So it's just an idea that this journalist is tossing about, but it's a very logical one. It's obviously different aspects of this have been considered in the past. And so it seems like it's a very feasible way that Europe could make just a huge step towards greater unity. So I think that's definitely both of these trends, a common European tax and a common European military, as a solution to this problem of needing more military spending in a time of austerity, is definitely something to really watch for.
Thank you, Richard. Brent?
After a decade of denying that it has ever worked on a nuclear weapon, the IAEA's conclusion about the pre-2009 period are definitive. And they said Iran did work on a nuclear weapon before 2009. Now, throughout the whole nuclear deal negotiations, Iran completely denied that it has ever worked on any nuclear weapons, that there are no military dimensions to their atomic energy program, yet that has been proven false by the IAEA, and yet the nuclear deal is still going through. The Obama administration said in response to this that it's still likely that sanctions are going to come down here in January, and said, well, they haven't been working on anything since 2009. That sounds reassuring.
Thank you, Brent. They lied to us before, but we know they're not lying to us now. Jeremiah, go ahead from Asia.
Russian President Vladimir Putin's popularity is higher than ever. It's approaching a perfect 10 right now, which means the Russian population, for the most part, has come to see him as Putin the Great. They see him as increasingly almost infallible, and that means that they would back him with total support for just about anything. A lot of this is due to the remarkable effectiveness of the Russian state media and the well-oiled propaganda machine that's just running on overdrive over there. The Trumpet Weekly this week includes an article from Real Clear World, and it says that this effectively means the Russian people are becoming weaponized, a vehicle for Vladimir Putin and his palace guard at the Kremlin to use at their disposal. If Moscow wants to annex Crimea, the people will support it. If Moscow wants to support the regime of Assad with military force, even as the latter drops barrel bombs on his people, the Russian people will support it. If Moscow wants to further expand the Russian empire at the expense of some other nation state, the people will, of course, support it. So Putin is just about invincible now. This means he'll only leave office when he wants to leave. And for as long as he chooses to stay in there, he can just push ahead with expansionism and all sorts of really pushy foreign policy.
Thank you, Jeremiah. Anthony from the English-speaking world.
In a landmark decision, U.S. Defense Secretary Ashton Carter said on Thursday that he's opening all jobs in combat units to women. He said they are no exceptions. This means that as long as they qualify to meet standards, women can now contribute to our mission in ways they could not do before. Now, there's two sides to this. There's the fitness aspect to it. You might remember that last year, minimum standards for women was delayed because about half of the female recruits at Paris Island failed a test that men are typically subjected to. Men and women are different physically. That should make sense because men are males, women are females. But there are other aspects to it as well. We have a different emotional makeup, and Mr. Hilliker once wrote an article about it, just talking about some of the problems that come with this development. Having women serve in the army, they actually endanger men who are serving in the military. There is a program that has been developed by the army just to train men to be able to cope with the screams of women when they are injured in war. So that's a sad development right there.
Thank you, Anthony. The Paris Climate Summit is in full swing, and United States President Barack Obama arrived in France on Monday to attend it. In his opening speech, he apologized to the world for how America has helped cause global warming. He said he personally came to the conference as the, quote, leader of the world's largest economy and the second largest emitter to say the USA not only recognizes our role in creating this problem, we embrace our responsibility to do something about it. But the question is, what exactly does that mean? Are the Paris talks really about saving lives, preventing Islamic extremism, as people have intimated, or is it about stopping the Earth from global warming or something else? And the reality is the talks are about something altogether different. They're about starting a revolution. In February, the executive secretary for the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change had some extremely revealing words. She said, quote, "This is the first time in the history of mankind that we are setting ourselves the task of, get this, intentionally within a defined period of time to change the economic development model that has been reigning for at least the last 150 years since the Industrial Revolution." She continued, "This is probably the most difficult task we have ever given ourselves, which is to intentionally transform the economic development model for the first time in human history." So this, folks, is what the Paris Climate Summit is all about. It's about revolutionizing the world's economic system. And what system is that? Yep, you guessed it, capitalism. Just to confirm, Pope Francis said on Monday, the world is headed towards suicide if a climate agreement isn't reached. And then he went on to talk about how Africa is a victim of capitalism and how Africa is exploited and has been exploited by capitalistic nations that don't care about it. Called Africa a martyr for the exploitation of history. And he said because of that, Africa is stuck in poverty and social injustice. Earlier this year, he called capitalism the dung of the devil. And he said capitalism has increased inequality and destruction of the environment. Now, the Pope is just one force behind the Paris Summit, even though he's a very powerful one. But all you have to do is take a look at the various climate change protests taking place in the world, and you'll see very, very obviously that they're filled with anti-capitalists, anti-socialists, increasingly even openly communist activists. And these people aren't the hangers-on. These are the protest organizers. But don't take my word for it. Go to thetrumpet.com and read the article, "The Paris Climate Summit is All About Money, Power, and an Economic Revolution." The evidence is there. It's documented. Just click on the links. Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. That brings us towards the end of our program. I'm Robert Morley. This is the Trumpet Hour, your radio host today, filling in for Joel Hilliker. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Go there to receive a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. All of these stories we talked about today are in there, as well as to links to trumpet articles and further explanation. Send us your thoughts, questions by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. Follow us on Twitter @thetrumpet_.com. Find us on Facebook and Google Plus. Just search Philadelphia Trumpet. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Richard Palmer, Brent Noctegal, Anthony Chabarway.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I will leave you all with some words of wisdom from Winston Churchill. You have enemies? Good. That means you have stood up for something sometime in your life. And that's exactly what we attempt to do each week on the Trumpet Hour. We stand up for truth, honesty, and reality in a very dangerous world. Thank you all for joining us on the Trumpet Hour. Hope you have enjoyed it. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on The Voice, 101.3 KPCG, and on the web at kpcg.fm.